Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our speaker tonight is Aaron Hurst, and our program is The Purpose Economy, People, Passion, and Profits. So I would like to tell you a little bit about Aaron before we start. Aaron Hurst is a globally recognized entrepreneur and authority on social innovation. He's the CEO of Imperative, a career development platform that connects professionals to purpose in their work. He's also the founder and advisor to the Taproot Foundation, where he was the lead architect in developing the $15 billion pro bono service market. Aaron's a regular blogger for the Huffington Post, Stanford Social Innovation Review, and is a LinkedIn influencer. Please help me welcome Aaron Hurst.
Thanks, Kevin. It's good evening. It's so great to be back at the Commonwealth Club. We moved my wife and my kids to New York about 5 years ago, and there are a lot of things I miss about the Bay Area, but the Commonwealth Club is definitely among the top. I think this is, as they said earlier, such a gem, and I don't know of any other city that has a platform like this where people can really connect and talk about the issues that matter in society. So wonderful to be back at the Commonwealth Club and to be with you talking about my passion, which is purpose, and hoping to spend, you know, this hour talking to you about what science is now telling us about the nature of purpose and purpose at work, and how I believe it's part of the fourth economy in our history, that it is going to be the economy that surpasses the information economy as the next major economy in our society. So what I'd like to start with, though, is the journey that led me here, because I think it really speaks to why I'm passionate about this and why I'm doing this. And it begins really with the Taproot Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization I started in 2001 with a goal to really change the role of professionals in society, to make giving back your skills and your talents a core part of what it means to be in marketing or technology or HR. I saw that the legal profession had a great precedent of pro bono work and doing pro bono work, but other professions didn't have that. And we built out the Taproot Foundation, and we built out pro bono service programs at dozens and dozens of companies around the world and around all kinds of different issues and communities. And the thing that I heard over and over again, which is part of what led to leaving Taproot to start Imperative and to write The Purpose Economy, was that people said that their pro bono work was the most rewarding, wonderful work they had in their careers. It was the most powerful work they did. And at first, we celebrated that because it was such an amazing idea. Like, these people were having this profound experience at work. It was so powerful for them. But then I realized there was something incredibly sad about that, because the reality is most people don't do pro bono work all the time. They do pro bono work as a supplement for their work, and that we have a fundamental problem in our society where work isn't nearly what it could be. And I took it upon myself as a challenge as an entrepreneur to really ask the question, how can we make all work feel like pro bono work? Sort of a simple question, but a very hard one to answer. How do we make all work, all the work we do, feel like what these folks are reporting pro bono work feels like? And it's been a wonderful journey of speaking with leaders who are finding new ways of running organizations, and with academics at Michigan, Penn, and at Yale, who are doing breakthrough research just in the last few years about what actually generates purpose for us at work. No one's answered the question yet of what's the meaning of life, or the purpose of life, but we actually now have a pretty good sense for what generates purpose for us at work. And that's what I'd like to share with you tonight, what they found, because it radically changed my understanding of the role of work in our lives and what good work is. So before I do that, I need to help dispel some of the myths about purpose at work, because I realized I was carrying around a lot of falsehoods about what actually generates purpose, and my guess is many of you are as well. Since I was working in this field for 10 years and was wrong, the odds are many other people had the same challenge. The first is that people believe purpose and causes are the same thing. They believe that finding purpose is about finding your cause. When I was at Taproot, professionals would come in all the time, and they'd say, I can't find meaning in my work. I can't figure out what my cause is. I don't know if it should be education or healthcare or puppies or whatever the issue is that's going to give them purpose. And they think that finding a cause is finding purpose. The reality is there's almost no correlation between the two at all. I think all of you can think of people in your lives that have causes, support a lot of causes. They check the box on Facebook and LinkedIn about the causes they support. But you'd actually ask them, you'd say, these people have no purpose in their lives at all. A lot of people with causes have no purpose in their work. And I think the flip side is also true. A lot of people I've worked with and have met have tremendous purpose in their work, and I couldn't name a single cause that they stand behind or that they work towards. Purpose and causes are not the same thing. So that's the first thing that we have to let go of to understand purpose. That's a big change. And society pushes this idea of causes. They do it in cause marketing. They do it on those social media platforms. Publicists work with Hollywood actors all the time to make them tell stories about how they found their cause, and with that they found meaning in their lives. But it's all just storytelling. It's not the reality of what generates purpose. So that's sort of the first myth. The second myth, which ties again to the same idea, is that purpose is a revelation. That just like Moses, you're going to get hit by lightning and all of a sudden be given tablets that tell you what's going to bring purpose to your life, right? And I think that worked well for him, but I haven't found anyone else who's had that experience. And it sounds ridiculous, but I'm amazed, and including myself, how many people think they're one New York Times article away or a experience in the community or a trip to Africa from figuring out what is going to bring purpose to their lives. And it's ridiculous, but a lot of us carry that idea that we're just like one block away or one article away from like finding the thing that we're deeply passionate about and brings purpose. And it prevents a lot of people from seeing that purpose is a journey. It's about the day-to-day. It's not about getting to a destination. It's not about something that's just going to come to you in the middle of the night or being struck by lightning. So that was a second myth that I had to let go of. The third, and this one's the hardest one, especially for progressive folks like myself, which is purpose isn't a luxury. I think for a long time, because we thought of purpose tied to charities and causes, we think people can only work on things that give them purpose once they're at a certain socioeconomic class so they can afford it. It's like it comes with your yacht, the ability to have purpose, right? And it's fascinating how much we believe that. And this is probably the one I get the most debates about, because people have a hard time believing that someone who doesn't have a lot of money or someone who's struggling economically could have purpose, right? And it's actually, what I've found is they're almost inversely correlated. That actually it's often the people without economic means have more purpose in their lives. And most of the CEOs I know have the least purpose in their work and lives. And that, in fact, we have this one kind of backwards. And for the people who still sort of argue this point, I think there's no better example than our friend Viktor Frankl, right? Who's one of the leading authors on purpose. And he said purpose is what got him through life in a concentration camp, right? And if someone in a concentration camp can find purpose in that day-to-day existence, I think it's hard for us to say that any job could be worse than being a slave in a concentration camp. So these are the things we have to let go of. We have to let go of the idea that purpose is a cause, that purpose is a revelation, and that purpose is something that is a luxury. So the question becomes, what is purpose? What does science say? So purpose at work comes from three things. The first is relationships. We get purpose by being around other people, interacting with people, supporting each other. You can get purpose by yourself in a room, but it's a lot harder. And research shows over and over again that purpose is fundamentally like a social thing. The second is through doing something greater than yourself. And again, this doesn't have to be a cause. It doesn't have to be world peace. It can be helping a neighbor. It can be working on a product or a service that makes people's lives a little bit better. Be helping a coworker. It's little things where we're doing something that's about more than just ourselves. And the third is growth, professional, personal growth. When we do things that scare us, when we do things where we grow as individuals, that process is one that generates purpose for us. These are the three things that generate purpose. It's relationships, something greater than yourself, and growth. And if you think about those three things and say, where do you see those in abundance? You see them a lot in the millennial generation, right? Those that were born in the 80s and 90s that are really becoming professionals now. And you think about what are the priorities of this generation. And those of you that are millennials or work with millennials see this. They want relationships. Research shows they want their coworkers to be like a second family. They want purpose, and they want to do something that makes a difference in their work. And they want to grow, which is why they're always wanting to be promoted. And people are like, they always want to be promoted. Like, what's wrong with them? It's not actually a desire for promotion. It's the desire for new challenges and mixing it up and growing and the incredible vitality that brings. So those are the three things that bring purpose to our work. Incredibly important. But another set of research I'm going to share with you now, I think, brings a little more texture to that. So these researchers looked at people's attitude towards work, their orientation towards what work is about. What is the story they tell about the role of work in their lives? And it breaks into three groups. The first group, think about work as a job. It pays the bills. It's what's necessary to do what you want to do outside of work. As someone told me today, those are the people that are coin-operated. Like, they work based on, like, getting resources, and that's what they're about. The second is career. These folks work so that mommy and daddy are proud of them. They work so that when they go back to their high school reunion, everyone's like, yeah, nice work. Like, you did well. It's about social status, climbing the ladder. It's about your identity. And that's the story that they're told. And the third is calling, which I didn't label, and it's a little misleading as a label. But it's basically people who see work as something that actually generates purpose in and of itself. They see the day-to-day of the actions they do at work as generating purpose. And they often see work as something that helps make the world a better place. So there's these three categories: job, career, calling. Somewhat interesting, not like groundbreaking. What's groundbreaking is what they then found, which is that roughly a third of the population see work as a job and are coin-operated, a third see it as a career, and a third as calling. So it's almost an even split. What's even more shocking is that it really doesn't matter what the profession is. So doctors, a third of them see it as a job, pays well, or at least it used to. Some see it as something that they can tell mommy and daddy or go back to a high school reunion and say, I'm a doctor, and they're going to feel good about it. And a third truly love the practice of medicine and truly get purpose out of the work itself. The same thing's true of executive assistants. A third are job, a third career, a third calling. That's fascinating, right? And it goes against so much of what I thought, at least, that certain jobs are high in purpose and others aren't. And it only draws one incredibly important conclusion after you look at that, which is we decide. Purpose is a choice. If someone could have the exact same job and have purpose or not have purpose, the only conclusion you can draw is that that's a choice and that's about who they are, not about the job, and that we have to take responsibility for purpose in our lives. And it's not like these three are equal ways of being. Job, career, and calling. People who are in calling are shown to be more satisfied with their lives and with their work, and they're also better employees. They're more loyal. They're better colleagues. They're more productive. Calling is where it's at. Work with purpose is where it's at, which is, again, really interesting as you think about our workforce. How do we get more people into this category of calling? How do we get more people to embrace purpose as the core story they bring into their work? And we're now seeing some really interesting innovations about how organizations are helping people bring more purpose into their work. For a long time, we recognized that work wasn't working very well, high disengagement, and we thought, let's create volunteer programs, yoga, nap rooms, like all these things around it, but we weren't addressing the core, which is work itself. And I think what's really powerful about this new research is it's showing ways, instead of adding supplements, we can actually make a healthier meal. We can make work itself more fulfilling. So there's a couple ways that we look to do that. The first step is we've got to find ways to help people become self-aware. And that's why we created imperative.com, which is a website where we're building out tools to help people build that self-awareness. And we have a diagnostic tool that in 15 minutes helps you understand psychologically what drives purpose for you, right? And it really helps you understand what's really going to provide that mojo. But that's not enough. We got to help people act on it. And what we're seeing is that there's a whole field of research around the idea of job crafting. And how do we actually go from the idea of like wearing clothes where you just buy it off the rack and it sort of fits and you sort of wear it and it's sort of comfortable to actually being able to make alterations to our jobs and actually fitting them to our actual bodies and who we are. And this is what we see the people who are really high in purpose in their work do. They take that outfit and they alter it to their style. They make it fit who they are. And one of the places they saw this, which was a wonderful story, is with orderlies at hospitals. And this is a profession that is treated really, really poorly by their coworkers. Doctors and nurses and administrators are not nice to these folks. And I won't tell you the stories because most of them are like too upsetting, frankly, to even like want to talk about. But they found a lot of these folks, again, a third of them were like high in calling, high in purpose in their work. And they said, what is going on here? And what they found is that they were job crafting. They took their basic job description and they altered it to bring purpose. So a lot of them, when the doctors and nurses weren't looking, would go and sing to patients. They would dance and they would tell jokes to patients. It's like amazing, right? Not part of their job. And some of them they found in long-term care wards would actually move art around because they didn't want people to look at the same art day after day. And they were often the ones that were really helping family members connect to patients where doctors and nurses were too busy. And they really fundamentally felt like they were as important as the doctor or nurse to their work. They still got their job done, but they made it their own. And this is what we're seeing companies starting to do, and part of what we're trying to help companies do is how do we help people using their purpose profile to start to change that 20%, to alter their job a little bit so that it maximizes purpose in what they're doing. And that's really the second step. How do we go from self-awareness to crafting those clothes to fit better? Then it comes down to how do we start building community around this? We've been doing experiments around people who share a purpose profile. And we do this on our team where we have fellows look in our database of people who've taken our diagnostic and find someone that has a job that they think sucks, like that they would never want. And we're like, call them up and let's have a conversation with them because they share a purpose profile about why they like their job or what they get out of it. And it, without exception, they get off the call and they say, I have a new best friend. And oh my God, what a cool job they have. This is the job they just said they would never want because they saw it through the lens of someone of the same purpose psychological profile, and they realize how you could generate purpose out of that job. People who connect around purpose, not just around their ethnicity or gender or profession, but actually connect around what gives them purpose, builds an incredibly strong bond that we can start to build organizations and society around now that we can categorize purpose. And this is an incredible tool for building culture. And the final piece is around how do we do reward and celebration in organizations, right? And most companies celebrate job and career. They don't celebrate calling. Great example is I was talking to folks at Yelp and then at a new company called Zarly. And they both bang gongs in their sales team. It's one of their rituals. They bang a gong. But what's interesting is they do it for radically different things. Yelp bangs a gong when they close a deal. When someone has written a check to say they will give Yelp money, they're like, woohoo, and they bang their gong, right? Zarly bangs a gong when someone sends them an email saying, you changed my life. Your service enabled me to take an action in my life that's made my life better. And they bang the gong for that. That's a much stronger culture because people are fundamentally connecting to impact and purpose. And a lot of companies bang gongs. I don't know where that came from. But a lot of them do it figuratively without like a literal gong. But they celebrate things. And they tend to celebrate, we got press, we got more money. They don't do enough to celebrate the actual impact of their work. And it's a tremendous opportunity to change the way we do rewards and celebration in organizations to focus on that calling mentality that builds a much better culture. So those are really the keys we see, and we're trying to work to change organizations to maximize purpose. And it's part of a broader movement that we're leading to build this purpose economy that's about not just jobs, but about changes in retail and in finance and in healthcare and education that we see going on overall. That are actually, when we look at it, these same drivers of relationships, growth, and doing something greater than yourself is where we're seeing most of the innovation happening in every industry in this country. And that we're actually seeing the early seeds of a fourth economy. My uncle coined the term information economy when he was at Stanford and proved that it had become the third economy in our history. But we now believe that we're in the early days of this new economy, this purpose economy. And part of what we're doing is we're going around the world and we're saying Detroit was the epicenter in the U.S. of the industrial economy, right? Silicon Valley has been the hub of the information economy. Another city will likely rise as the epicenter of the purpose economy. And how do you, instead of trying to compete with Silicon Valley, how can you try to build your city to leapfrog that and become the capital of this new economy? And we're having mayors all around the country starting to galvanize their cities around trying to build the infrastructure, the culture, to actually build a city on purpose. And we actually are doing a conference as part of the U.S. Conference of Mayors next month in Dallas to think about what is the blueprint for a purpose economy capital, for a purpose economy city, one that's based on relationships, doing something greater than yourself, and growth. And we really see this as the future, and we feel like, yes, it's full of optimism. Maybe it's a little Pollyannish, but we actually believe, and I believe strongly, that when you believe in something, when you have hope, you can actually make that happen. And we're seeing it. We're seeing that when you give people a sense of direction, a vision, they're making changes in themselves and their organizations, et cetera. So with that, I would love to open this up to discussion with all of you about purpose, organizations in the purpose economy, the purpose economy writ large, what generates purpose for you in your lives, and ideas for how we can make this happen, because there's never been a more important time for us to get behind purpose, because we've got some real challenges in our world right now, and the only way we're going to get there is with hope and purpose. So it's incredibly important. So with that, again, love to open it up. Any questions from the audience? We've got a microphone perfectly placed for this gentleman here. I think he's going to turn it on, just 1 second. There'll be a little musical interlude. I think he's, yeah.
Hello?
Yep, we're good. And what's your name, sir?
I'm Ryan. How are you?
Great.
I've done your diagnostic. It's pretty good.
Awesome.
How do seniors fit into this? The retiring generation?
Yep, great question.
I'm curious.
So how do seniors fit into the purpose economy? So if you look at the boomer generation, which is largely what seniors are becoming defined as. First of all, they've been an incredible part early in their careers in the creation of this economy. And the model I look to as the future of how we manage organizations is really community organizing, which is something that largely came out of the boomer generation in the 60s. So incredible legacy there. What we're seeing is because people are living longer and longer, people are working longer and longer. And that a lot of sort of quote-unquote seniors are working into their 70s and even 80s. And my father, who's out in Boulder, Colorado, actually at the age of, I think, 67, became a social entrepreneur. He sort of followed in my footsteps in sort of reverse, which is awesome. And I think he's one of thousands of professionals who are, having gone a different path, are coming later in their careers to remember the values they had when they were in college and fresh out of college and redesigning their second acts around values and around purpose. And you see them doing what Mark Friedman calls encore careers. And they're really changing a lot of this. The other piece is because they're living longer, we're finding tremendous growth in a profession that surprised me. The fastest growing profession in the U.S., I honestly thought it was going to be software developers. The fastest growing profession in the U.S. is home healthcare aides. And it's interesting because now that women are largely integrated into the workforce, we're starting to have to outsource childcare, home care, and caring for our parents. And it's creating the fastest growing part of the labor market. And to me, that's fascinating also because men were the economists of old, work at home was never counted as an economic output, right? It never counted because that's women's work. Why would you count that, right? And what's happened, which is fascinating, is, and actually they estimated at one point that it was like 20, the GDP would grow by something like 20 or 25% if you counted in the work we do at home. But now that that's actually becoming monetized, that's starting to show up, and it's part of this new economy, all this like high-purpose work in the home. So any other questions? Yep.
Why do they even have a label?
Why do they even have, who's that? Why do we have the label of senior?
Yeah.
No, I think it's a...
Why do we categorize?
Yep.
Instead of just going to
Aaron, can you repeat the question?
Yeah, sure. So my 25-year-old friend on the front asked the question, why do we even call seniors seniors, and why do we have to label people? And I'd like to say like up front that I think I would hope that early on it was because it was a sign of respect, and it was a sign of being able to respect elders. I think now we've got a society that's all about youth. And it's funny, now as an entrepreneur raising capital and being 40 years old, I'm often told I'm like too old to be an entrepreneur. So it's fascinating how like I'm considered like already like aged out of being an entrepreneur, which is pretty fascinating. So I think we've got a real problem with that and these labels. And I've met some amazing 25-year-olds in the bodies of 85-year-olds, and I think we need to recognize that more and more.
That's great. I'd like to remind our audience listening at home that this is the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club, and your host for tonight. Our program tonight is The Purpose Economy, Passion, Community, and Profits with our speaker, Aaron Hurst. So I will now turn it over for our next question.
Let's go back here. And if you have questions, it would be great to get in line behind this lady just to make sure we capture them all for everyone. Yeah, please.
Hi, my name is Meg, and I spent 10 years at a Fortune 100 company. At the end of last year, they defunded my business unit. So now I'm a woman of leisure. And I was in healthcare, and I started a small group of what I call women in transition.
Yep.
And I've attracted all these women to this group, And I can see as they're talking about what they're doing or what they want to do that they're searching for purpose.
Yep.
But there's a strong call of going back into a big job or having a big title and all these pieces that seem somewhat at odds with finding what is meaningful to you. So I was hoping you'd have some suggestions about what I can do with these women to help move them forward and release them from some of our assumptions about what we have to be and do.
Great question. It's great that you brought that group together because I think it's so important to have that support, especially during those moments of transition. So kudos to you for doing that. I mean, I honestly got to say it's less, again, about finding a cause or thinking about mission. The research shows that early on in a startup, in an early stage organization, mission matters a lot. And you have this incredible energy around purpose around a mission. But as an organization scales, organization mission and what the organization does has very little impact on the purpose of the individual employee. And that's why so many nonprofits, their employees lack purpose, which is pretty like shocking when you first hear it. But at Taproot, we would have volunteers from the Red Cross and these big nonprofits and even midsize where they wanted to do volunteer work because their work at a nonprofit wasn't generating purpose. Because what happens is that you start to need to have purpose from the craft of what you do, not just from the mission. So I would say like don't judge them for wanting or even being able to go back to a big company or going to a corporation. I think purpose comes from how they do that job and how they approach it, and less the fact that they've got to go find the equivalent of the Peace Corps for their work. They can get it through the relationships growing and like connecting to work that matters to them within an organization. And I went through this process of trying to struggle with like what is success personally for myself, because I was trying to figure out like why am I working so much, what am I doing? And I played this game with myself where I said, what would be the ultimate success? Not necessarily for me, but in general, right? And the answer that seemed most obvious is President of the United States, right? That's like the ultimate job, right? And then I was like, that job would suck. Like I would never want that job, and it's probably one of the least purpose-oriented jobs there is. And then I thought about like the next couple tiers down of jobs, and they're all jobs that don't necessarily have purpose. And you could also, even the president in 300 years doesn't really make much of a difference at that level either. It's like it's a fool's errand to like focus on this bigger impact. It's about the day-to-day. And when I talk to older folks about their memories of their career and what they're proud of, it's never those big impacts. It's about a relationship, someone they worked with, some small project they did that they were proud of. And I think those are the things we need to focus on and not hold ourselves up saying we have to find that perfect job. It's about finding the perfect attitude towards it. So there's my long-winded answer to your question.
I don't think it's a surprise to a lot of people that many organizations in the industrial and information economy focus on metrics.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering to what extent you find metrics still relevant, and to the extent that they're still relevant, are you seeing a whole new set of metrics emerge?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think it's a hard balance. I mean, when we invented the assembly line over 100 years ago, like it was this amazing invention, and we tried to apply it to everything. And there's a great quote by the Secretary of Education at the time about how education at its best would be exactly like an assembly line. And we now know how bad that is, right? And you wouldn't want that. And to have everyone like sort of just marching like robots. You know, I think similarly, there's been such great inventions out of the information economy and with data. But there's a place where you take that too far. And I think we have to find where that balance is, where we leverage it for what's good and what's not. There are some great new measures, especially around well-being, which is much more important than happiness. And you see some countries like Bhutan starting to measure their gross happiness index and looking at that, city of Santa Monica. You see companies like Etsy that we've worked with where they're starting to measure the well-being of their employees and track that over time. I think these are the metrics that really matter. I think also I'd love to see education, when people are graduating from school, that schools are held more accountable to what percentage of their graduates are graduating with calling as their job orientation. That's the greatest gift a university or a high school could give someone, is to have them leave school with that calling attitude, because that means they're going to be happier, have more well-being, and be better employees. So I think there are some measures, but we also have to be careful, because as soon as you start getting into social engineering, which is what this starts to become, you start to dehumanize it and almost go like against what it's about. And you also open up some experiments that are not ideal. For example, one of the pieces of research recently out of Michigan, they looked at different religious backgrounds and how many people worked with purpose, and they found certain cultures and religions had less orientation towards purpose at work. So you could draw the conclusion you shouldn't hire those people in your organization, right? So, which is obviously a horrible conclusion to draw, but I think we have to be really careful with a lot of this because It's much more dynamic. It's about people. It's not about numbers. Yeah.
Hi there. My question is around identifying your purpose.
Yeah.
Jean Houston did a lot of work. I don't know if you're familiar with her work. She's a phenomenal, done phenomenal work on finding your purpose. And I noticed from a lot of the comments back that people have a huge problem identifying their purpose. How do you go about that? What are, like, for example, so I know somebody who loves to do something as a hobby, and when I said, wow, that's really your calling in life, she said, no. I really love that as something that I just love to do, but it doesn't really bring meaning. And I see a lot of people struggling with identifying and really trying to get to the core of what their purpose is. How do I start to find out what my purpose is so I can do something that really is my calling? So I wonder if you'd any thoughts.
Yeah, and I think
that
it goes to, I think a lot of people look for purpose as a noun, mm-hmm. when in reality it's much more of a verb. Yeah. And therefore, like, we often get stuck because we're not thinking about it the right way. The best way, I mean, we have this tool on our site on imperative.com that helps people think through actually what drives purpose for them. And it's much more about how you approach your work than the work itself. Which is why I think when we try to figure out, like, the perfect career, that's the wrong question. We should be figuring out is what's the perfect attitude and approach to our work. The best practice I've seen is to take a couple weeks and every day at the end of the day or at the beginning of the day, write down one thing that day that gave you a moment of purpose. And just track that over a couple weeks, and you'll start to realize the patterns of what actually matters to you, and you start shaping your job and the work you do around it. I think people are trying to find this, like, grand sense of purpose are often missing the reality that it's just all around them because they're looking for that revelation, which is what a lot of what I'm, like, you know, hearing in stories like that. It's that revelation.
And just a very quick part B is I sometimes think the role of mentors is very important. I've seen really good mentors in my work really help people to, you know, learn about purpose. About what jobs are really about. So I would love your quick comment on
the role of mentors. Mentorship's great. I think the thing that we're really excited about is how do we start creating mentors around purpose, not just around function. Because mentorships tend to be around ethnicity, gender, or function. And we think that if you actually could be mentored with someone who has found ways of the same purpose type as you to maximize that in their career and seen success with that, that person is going to be the most powerful mentor you could have. But so critical, and it's part of our nature. Like, we learn from each other. We learn from people who've been on that journey before. So I think it's really vital. Yeah.
Hi, I work in the field of leadership development and organization development.
Awesome.
So I'm interested in hearing some of your stories about what organizations have done.
Yeah.
I work for a healthcare safety net, so I see this huge untapped purpose in an organization that's really adhering to behavioristic principles. So what have you done to get the leadership to understand this process or to think it's not, you know, new age, airy-fairy principles, to kind of break through and open up their minds to think in this way?
So I think, first of all, there's a lot of enlightened leaders out there. I think part of the challenge is to say there's a lot of organizations right now that don't have leaders that get this and that those people will transition out, and we should focus our energy on those who get it but are struggling with how to, like, bring it to life. Because I think that's where the best investment is made, is in people who are either, like, get it or they're close to it, but they just need help executing, and that the rest of them will come along. It's a traditional adoption curve. The same way early on a lot of business leaders didn't want to embrace technology, but eventually they all had to. I think the same thing will happen here. So I just really believe in, like, finding people who get it and then helping them make it happen. And it's not always the people you'd expect. I mean, one of the people I talk a lot about is Erica Karp, who's in New York, and she runs a financial services firm called Cornerstone Capital. And she does this in the most simple, elegant, beautiful way, which is she just asks people every day, how was your day? And I ask people that all the time, and I actually don't listen to what the answer is. I'm just sort of saying it as a salutation, right? But she actually asks it, and she listens to the answer. And what she does, if they say they had a good day, she says, well, what was the specific moment that made it a good day? And they share it. And she's like, that's great. And she asks that them over and over again over weeks and maybe months. And then she starts to find projects and to change their job to figure out how to make more of those moments happen. She's not using some performance management software. She's not doing some, like, complicated thing. She's just actually asking a question and listening and acting. So I think at some level the answer is, like, how do we become human again? HR, which many people in HR are amazing, but there's a huge part of HR that has created policies and created a fear culture that prevents us from being human. And we're actually going to be launching this fall with several other companies, Bring Yourself to Work Day. Because we think there's a fundamental need to get back to bringing yourself to work. And we need to create a culture where that's celebrated, right? Because we're not allowed to do it. And I think HR at its best I describe as a trampoline. It gives you bounce. HR at its worst is a cement floor that deadens every step. And we need to figure out how to change that and really do that. And I was talking to the folks over at Huffington Post, and one of the things they did is they said, let's stop having policies to prevent bad behavior based on one employee did something wrong. Let's create policy around finding people who did something great and figure out how more people can do that. Why do we create laws around the one bad apple instead of around the 10 amazing apples, right? And that's what we tend to do because we're so scared of litigation, et cetera. I talked to one great, courageous leader, and they're like, sue me. I don't care. Like, I'm going to be human, and I'm going to do the right thing. And if that means that it increases the odds of liability, like, so be it. I care more about being able to look at myself in the mirror and being human. So I think it's just that courage, which is why when you go to talk to people who don't get this, who are like strongly of that job or career background, you're generally wasting your time, from my point of view. So,
thank you.
Yeah. Sir.
So being one of these privileged people that feels that they don't have the problem that you're relating to.
Yeah.
It seems to me that we live in a society that is overtaken by advertising and by the image of money in a way that is really directing most people in a direction completely contrary to where you're telling everybody to go. And I have respect for what you're saying.
Yep.
Because I think that, in fact, this is a personal decision.
Yep.
On the part of everybody. And in fact, they have to make up their mind what's going to be worthwhile for their lives and
sure.
attempt to do it as well. But on the other hand, an effective economy is one that gives opportunity to people to live those lives.
Yep.
And so then how do you somehow collect the wonders of capitalism and the ideas that you have into something which is a message that can be related to the general public in an
I think a lot of the general public gets this, and especially in the millennial generation. I mean, you see pretty major attitudinal shifts around the idea of, like, for example, consumption versus creation, right? And you see more and more the idea of sharing, the idea of people becoming makers again. You see more and more people choosing work that doesn't pay as much because they care more about purpose. You see this more and more, and you may, you know, there's obviously pockets and exceptions to all of this, but I work with a lot of millennials that look at all the research, and it tends to point to the fact that there is a real shift in our thinking around consumption, and that more and more, and this is good and bad also, that in my generation of boomers, it was all about conspicuous consumption, right? It was about, like, I remember in high school, like, you wore the baseball cap that had the tag still on it so people could see that it was brand new, right? And, like, the cool sneakers and stuff, right? Because that was how you showed identity. And what's interesting with Facebook and these other social media platforms is we're almost having like this weird perverted sense of conspicuous consumption of purpose, and everyone is being judged on who they are largely by how they represent themselves online. And people are collecting things they're doing that are better for the world, that are about how good a person they are, as a way of defining their identity. And it's creating a keeping up with the Joneses. But in this case, it's like keeping up with the Joneses about how many causes you've supported and what you've bought and where you've been and what you've experienced, and creating much more of a culture around conspicuous consumption of experience and of purpose. And it's interesting. I mean, it's in some ways still not a great thing because it's about competition, but
no,
we're
I'm
seeing...
I'm about to ask you, is that a good sign? I mean, is it reasonable to have Zuckerberg, one of the richest people in the world, on the basis of an idea he had before he was 20 years old? I mean, well...
Right, which is not... I mean, I think there's a whole... Entrepreneurship has been so romanticized in our culture. And to me, as an entrepreneur, I'm the first to say entrepreneurship is a sign of mental illness. And that if you look at the studies, like, most entrepreneurs are not... Like, it's
he
not
doesn't feel very
envy.
Ill, I can tell you that.
There you go. But I think it's a difference between separating that out and, like, I think a lot of this, like, crazy gambling-style wealth that's being created, and looking at how people are using some of these platforms and how it's changing how we show our identity in public. And I'd much rather have someone, even though it's still not ideal, showing off what causes they support than showing off what shoes they bought. So it's a step in the right direction, which I'm glad to see.
All right, thank you.
Hi, thanks for being here tonight.
Oh, pleasure.
I'm a little confused, and this may not be clear. I'm going to do my best.
Please.
But, The Kelly brothers were here a few months back,
okay,
and just inspired the hell out of me about, they talked about jobs, careers, David talked about jobs, yep, careers, callings, and how they flip people, how they open them, yep, to what's already there, which is very human. And yep, that's something I've experienced in things where I've really believed in what I'm doing and that it's helping people. And when I think of economy, I think of something motivated by something measurable, typically money.
Yep.
When I think of competitive cities for, yep, the one leading the purpose economy, yep, I think of the motivations that are very different from that which calling means to me.
Yep. So I think it's, I mean, what's interesting is purpose has been around forever, right? I mean, I'm sure cavemen looked for purpose. I'm not sure if my dog does, but it's possible. We've been looking for purpose forever. I think what's interesting now is that as we've moved up Maslow's hierarchy of needs, it's becoming something that's commercializable, if that's a word. It's being something that can be monetized because people are seeking it and they're actually willing to make economic decisions based on it, whether as employees or as consumers with what they're doing. And that's making it so that it's no longer a nice to have or something on the side, but it starts to become a business imperative to be able to make sure that people are providing jobs that generate purpose, and that they're providing the right products and services for people that generate that sense of purpose. And that's really why it's becoming economic, is because it's actually changing our buying and labor practices. And that's the point at which it becomes economy. And there are problems with capitalism. I would rather have an economy based on meeting people's need for purpose than information or industry. I think it's a much healthier economy to base
on. Making money?
Or making, well, and I think the making money, I think to a point, I mean, I think the research shows that after a certain point, diminishing return. It's also interesting, there's new research that just showed that people who are focused in their career on making money, like that's their primary driver, they're coin operated, this shows that they, with almost without exception, didn't have a good relationship with their mother. Which is really interesting to think about, like where that comes, where this stuff all comes from. And to think about like how we get imprinted in these different approaches. So I just wrote about that for Mother's Day because I think we don't do enough. I don't think we do enough to celebrate mothers, and especially now that most mothers have 30 different jobs they're doing, and to realize now it's actually the role of men in imprinting career on kids is actually not nearly as important as women is fascinating. So,
thanks.
I hope you're a tiny bit less confused.
I'm less confused. I'm still. It's an unclear.
It's a hard thing to reconcile because the two, they come out of different parts of our brain in some
hard
level.
Hard thing to measure.
Yeah.
It's something to feel. I have felt the difference.
And you can measure it around decisions.
But the reason it feels really measured is the idea of having cities compete to be the, yep, industrial center of this.
Yep.
Why? Why wouldn't you want it to be everywhere? I mean, you know, we couldn't.
Competition
make
is the best way to make it everywhere is why.
Okay.
Because if we can get every city competing for it, they're all going to invest in it, and therefore the hope is that that creates, it rises all of them. Even if none of them become the hub, it's a way to get everyone to have a sense of hope. Because right now we have a lot of politics and business built on fear, and it's trying to do something that's built on hope. So that's the thought there. I hope every city is the capital of the purpose economy. I think the least likely cities probably are areas of Silicon Valley, just based on history, but who knows?
Hi.
Hey.
Hi. So I have a question. I can definitely relate to everything you're saying about the millennials and purpose. I'm a millennial, and I definitely feel that.
Yeah.
But I think something that we struggle with is when you're starting your career, at least at the point I'm at in my career,
yeah,
I work for a company where I absolutely believe in their mission and their purpose, and that's one of the reasons I love working there. But I'm pretty far removed from the mission and the purpose of the company.
Yep.
You know, many levels up before you're actually tied into that mission and, yeah, purpose. So how do you kind of frame it in your mind so you can feel involved in the direction the company is going and the mission and the purpose when you're so far away,
yep,
from the actual work that like ties into that mission and purpose?
So I think there's a couple things there. I think one is, and you'll see this in our diagnostic, there's certain people who need to be closer to the action of the mission of an organization, right? Those are more like the doctor types. And you may be one of those people that just, you need to be in a job where you are close to the front line. For most people, though, the mission of the organization is not where you're going to generate most of your purpose. It's going to be from the day-to-day. And again, that's where like that exercise of reflecting once a day on what's generated purpose for you that day is so important. And it's around your craft. It's around the people you work with. I had an email recently from a guy who took our diagnostic test, and he's like, shoot, I just quit my job, and I took this, and I realized I never should have quit my job. Because I took for granted all the things that generate purpose for that job and left because I get slightly more money, and I just assumed I would have the same thing at the next job. But it's the relationships. It's like whether or not you have the ability to grow. So I think it's trying to find ways to connect there. Or if you're someone who needs that frontline sense of purpose, you need to find a job where you're like working directly on the front line. You're not going to get it abstractly in a matrix organization. It's not natural to get it that way. We are not naturally meant to be operating in these huge organizations. It's got to be finding it around your sort of small community around you, which you can find inside a big company. But to look for it like in the ether, like you're not going to find it. It's got to be in the small community that's right around you. Yeah.
Hello.
Hi.
So you talk about one figuring out what type is the type of purpose that works with you.
Yeah.
But once you figure that out, say, how do you go to that next step of identify, like, oh, this is an organization that will provide that. Is it identifying roles within that organization? Or is there lists of, like, this type of, these organizations do well for this type of purpose? Like, how is it that you take that in that self-awareness, and then figure out what you to do with it, how to act on it.
So I think the first step around that is to, again, start with you. And it has a lot less to do with finding the right organization or finding the right job, but it's like learning how to appreciate that, what drives purpose for you in the day-to-day of where you already are, what you're already doing, whether you're working or not working, and really coming to like become really self-aware about what's actually generating purpose for you. The next step I would recommend then is trying to find people of similar purpose in different places and find out like what kind of environment enables them to thrive. I mean, our hope is with our platform, we'll eventually enable people to look for work based on purpose. And we'll be able to actually predict what it would feel like given your purpose profile to be one of 1,000 different jobs, right? We're not there yet, but I think the science is going to get to the point where we can start to actually do predictive modeling of careers so that you can do that. Culture matters, but I think the key thing in life, whether it's in relationships, work, et cetera, is that most of it's internal, it's not external. And to not let the external become an excuse for not doing your internal work. So again, like a Viktor Frankl found purpose in a concentration camp. Clearly, like that points to the fact that you can generate so much of it internally. And just challenge everyone to start there and not look for external reasons why not to do it.
Aaron, I've actually volunteered at Taproot.
Awesome.
Which was like an amazing experience. I work for a Silicon Valley company, and I also volunteer with Ashoka. My question to you is this, which is, given what you're saying that volunteering and finding purpose is so meaningful, why is it so difficult, like, you know, in a large company to get people to try it out?
Volunteering?
Volunteering or, you know, even attending or, you know, you could, you know, bring it up to them.
Yep.
But the involvement rate is minuscule. And I'm kind of interested to hear what your thoughts are.
Yeah, so it's a bunch of things. I think one is a lot of the people who are in that job or career category just aren't looking for it and they don't want it. And I think a lot of times we're trying to sell them something they don't want. And we project because we're on calling that they should want it because we see the value of it. And I think it's recognizing that, you know, if you actually want people in those other categories to do it, you've got to sell it differently. You've got to sell to a job person that this is going to help you make more money or to a calling person this is going to help your career. You find some of that. But part of it is we're trying to sell something to someone that they don't want and that they don't value. The second thing, which we saw a lot in Silicon Valley, and it used to be a major source of frustration running Taproot out of San Francisco, that all of these tech startups with all this money were giving no money to charity and doing no volunteering. I was like, what the hell is going on here, right? And why are they so lacking purpose? And I had it completely wrong. What I actually found was that when you're in a small stage organization where it's, you know, you're a David trying to fight a Goliath, you're trying to disrupt an economy or a market, when you're working with a tight group of people working around the clock, there's a tremendous amount of purpose in a lot of these early stage startups. Like, they're incredible. Like, it's hard to beat the kind of purpose you get in them, right? So it wasn't so much that they lacked purpose. It's actually they had so much of it, they never even thought that they needed to do these other things, right? But then what happens, and when they would call Taproot often, is they get to a certain stage where they're no longer able to provide purpose through the mission of the organization. They're having to provide it at the staff level, and they don't know how to do it. And they suddenly say, okay, we don't have enough purpose anymore. Let's supplement it with volunteerism. right? Instead of addressing the core issue, which is that the work they're having is not generating the purpose it needs. So a lot of what we're trying to do is at this stage of an organization is figure out, don't try to create Band-Aids. Let's actually try to make the culture you have rich in purpose to make that happen more. So that's my sense. I think the other thing is a lot of people don't know how to manage energy. A lot of people work a lot and they say, I don't have time to volunteer. And I found that time is never a real excuse. It's priority, which goes to the money and career side, or it's energy, right? I can always find more time to do things that give me energy, right? And I think a lot of people don't realize that volunteerism might give them energy, and they don't realize that they can make that extra time. Some of our best volunteers at Taproot worked 60, 70 hours a week and then volunteered on top of it. They didn't have any time, but they found it as actually what gave them the energy to do that work. So I think a lot of people, it's just an issue like that. So, yeah.
Hello.
Hey.
Two-part question for you. The first is you talked about the fourth economy is going to be this purpose economy.
Yeah.
Could you paint a picture for us of what you think, if there were no obstacles, what that would look like?
Yeah.
And then the second part is you talk a lot about the individual and finding purpose, self-reflection. What can organizations do to create incentives to help support that process?
Yeah, I mean, so I'll answer the
dreams,
second one
the
first,
incentives.
And then I'll go, yeah.
Thanks.
So, I mean, incentive-wise, I mean, a lot of it's just about, again, I think a lot of people want this. They just need to become aware of it and to know that it's something the organization celebrates and supports. So I don't think it needs a whole lot of incentive. I think it needs more a safe place to do it and awareness to do it. And then organizationally celebrate the things that actually create purpose in the organization. So, again, I think certain people aren't going to do it no matter what, but I think there's a lot of people who will, and let's focus on those that will. To the question of what does this purpose economy look like, I have a lot of like glimpses of it in different places. So maybe I can share with you some of those. And they really come, one, by looking at a city, right? How is a city going to change? And it's a lot more about building community, embedding local business, having schools actually be like core to the community and not separate from it, so that we're seeing that kind of action. A lot of it's around enabling people to spend far less of their time commuting and doing things that are low in purpose, but actually building communities around purpose and around smaller numbers of people, because that's how we generate purpose. When you look at it on an industry by industry level, like I take medicine, which is a great example. It used to be until not that long ago that the most common way you saw a doctor is they came to you. They actually went on a house call with a little black bag and came to your home. Which, when you think about it, like makes so much more sense. So like, why should you, as someone who's sick and not feeling well, get your butt out of bed, drag yourself in a room full of sick people to like wait to see a doctor, right? And it's wonderful to see that some of the key innovators in medicine, including Kaiser here in the Bay Area, are saying their goal is to get to the point where doctors, once again, and healthcare providers are coming to people when they're sick in their own bed, and building a relationship with a patient again, instead of it being sort of an industrial model or even an information economy model of medicine. So that's like one example of like a change that I'd expect to see. Another is in education. Our educational system is still based on the industrial economy. It's still based on the assembly line of how we think about it. And it's so broken, so broken. One of the interesting positive deviants in this is home health or homeschooling, which I'm not advocating for, and I don't think it's the solution. But what's interesting is homeschooling is growing 7 times faster than public school enrollment in this country. And in general, kids that are homeschooled are getting higher scores, higher performance than students in our school system. And I think what's interesting about that is, just like I talked earlier about how we're expected to fit exactly into a job and we don't customize it, our school system right now says that if you're a fifth grader, you should be at fifth grade level in math, English, science, gym, arts, et cetera. And that's not the way we actually develop. We might be in fifth grade in math, seventh grade in English, first grade in gym. I mean, you could be all over the map. And what homeschooling has done is it's enabled customization of education to the individual, and that's why it's so much more effective. It's a personalized attention and the ability to not rigidly fit everyone into that fifth grade assembly line, instead to teach to where they are. And I think this is really, and you see this with some technology like Khan Academy, we're changing education to fit and to like craft and actually work for the student. And then I think that's going to become like a major change we're going to see in the purpose economy. In finance, we're seeing that we're going back to, and those innovators going back to an older time of finance where lending was based on the character of the person and social capital. J.P. Morgan didn't lend money on credit scores. He didn't lend money based on a derivative of a derivative of a derivative. He lent money based on someone's reputation in the community and his understanding that if they didn't pay, that would affect their standing in the community. And new organizations like Lendo in New York are now learning how you can start to lend money again between each other and based on social capital. And he's finding it's lower cost, and he's finding the repayment rate is much higher than anonymous credit score driven finance. So sort of moving much more to like a neighbor-based financial system. And things like Kickstarter and Indiegogo that are enabling people to fund projects, and more people, you know, 40% of the workforce will be freelancers. More and more people taking ownership of their careers and not just working in these matrixes. So these are some of the things. I recently had a call with IKEA about like what is the mall of the purpose economy look like, which is a really fun exercise. And I really feel like the answer to this overall is something we have to design together. And as I'm going into cities saying, how do you become the capital? I'm not telling them the answer. I think a lot of what makes purpose purpose is that it's authentic and human and like it comes from the bottom up. So I'm really excited, and I'm sure I'll be wrong about an awful lot of it, but I think a lot of the things that will happen will surprise all of us and be 10 times more beautiful than we ever thought possible.
So your research has shown that a third of people work for money, and a third work for career, and a third work for purpose. Is that a natural law, or can we shift those percentages?
Yeah. So can sort of the fact that a third of people fit into each of these actually change with time? So I should first say it's not my research. I don't want to take credit for it. I just find really smart people and like find ways to tell their story. This is like one of the big challenges. I think it can be changed, but it's not easy to change. People, once they generally enter the workforce, have that attitude throughout their entire career. That if they come in as coin operated, they leave coin operated, right? And I think the challenge is you've got to fundamentally change the story that's imprinted on them largely by their role models as children, during adolescence especially. And it's really hard just to get someone to like give up on that, because they've constructed their safety net, their story on that, and they use that to have a sense of balance and comfort in their lives to know that that's the way it is. I think it's possible. I think the things that I would do if I had infinite resources to work on this, one is I would really look at children when they're adolescents, how do we at that moment, which is the best moment to make this impact, how can we invest more in imprinting on them this calling approach, regardless of what their parents' approach is? Major need for investment there. I think the second one, the best model I can think of about, I was trying to think of like who does a great job of taking someone's story, popping that bubble, and helping create a new one. It's not the first place I wanted to go, but you actually think about boot camps in the military. And there's a reason why people go to that, and it's like a period of time, and they have to like basically let go fully of their identity as they thought of it and like basically get reprogrammed, right? And there's a lot of problems with that, but I think there's a lot we can learn from that process of what it takes to enable someone to fully let go of those stories and have the confidence and support from others to be able to embrace like a new story. So I'm hoping that we'll find ways in college or later in careers to create experiences that are safe for people to be able to make that change. Because otherwise, you're right, we can help people have more purpose that already care about it, which is a great thing. But I think the bigger win is if we could find a way as a society to get to the point where we have like an entire society of people who have that calling approach. That, to me, would solve an awful lot of problems. But it's going to take some major social engineering to get to that point.
Okay, well, I'd like to remind our audience listening at home, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is The Purpose Economy with Aaron Hurst. We've only got time for about one more question right now, and I'm going to take advantage to ask you the big question.
Cheater.
So for all of us here in the Bay Area, where we have what seems like a great lifestyle, what can we really do? I mean, how much of what people are doing is just looking good, like you were talking about, how many things you can have on your Facebook page? And how much of it is a real human calling? And how can we embrace an authentic life? I mean, what, from your perspective and all the work that you've been able to do and the great place that you've had in the middle of all this, what advice do you have for us about how best to actually be authentic and true to ourselves?
Well, if you look as good as I do, that's probably enough. But for the rest of you,
right? But for the rest of us.
No, I think the I think the key to it, which I think has sort of been the theme all night, is you know, I hate to quote it because I'm always annoyed by people who do, but that whole Gandhi quote about be the change you want to see in the world, right? Which is way overused. But I think it's, again, it's about not looking externally for purpose. It's about looking internally at what generates purpose for you. And I think one of the things I believe, and I don't have research to back this up fully, although some research shows it somewhat true, is that purpose is contagious. And if you start living with purpose, it'll give other people the permission to live with purpose. It'll give your coworkers that permission. If you start shopping based on your values and purpose, that'll start to make a change. I think often we try to, especially in the Bay Area, because it's all about entrepreneurship and scale and big, when in fact we haven't done the most basic scaling, which is within ourselves. So my advice in the Bay Area is just look inside yourself, make the changes, don't look for others to solve the problem for you, and then have the courage to share that and talk about it and inspire others to do the same. So.
All right, well, our program tonight has been
The Purpose Economy. Our program tonight has been The Purpose Economy with Aaron Hurst. I'm Kevin O'Malley. I've been your host tonight on behalf of the Business and Leadership Forum. With that, I'd like to thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club and our audience listening at home for being part of our program. And with this, I'll close our program of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 125 years of enlightened public discussion.